Thanks for joining us. It's our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Gonsalves. He's a news columnist at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
And expected to join us a little later on the phone will be Josh Balling, the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Tim Wood will join us. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. And Sally Rose, the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Let's take a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands. Let's begin with the Aquinnah tribe of Gayhead on Martha's Vineyard. A few weeks back, we heard from the island tribe that they had a legal opinion from the federal government which said they could open an island casino parlor. So as Governor Patrick has been working with the Wampanoag of Mashpee, the Aquinnah has been largely left out of the conversation, Sean. Some people saw that as a way to get the governor to the table to discuss things.
Exactly. It was seen as by some observers as a power move, really, on the tribe's part. I don't think anybody really expects, you know, the island to be a place where there's really going to be a casino, but it didn't work. You know, or at least appears it didn't work. I mean, if the goal of saying, hey, we're going to build this bingo hall in Aquinnah was to get the governor to do it, his response was, well, let's file a lawsuit. I think the governor's office is very confident in their legal interpretation of this settlement act that the tribe, if folks remember, there was this 1983 land settlement, which essentially gave the tribe about 400 acres of land on the island, but they ceded certain rights in terms of basically they agreed to abide by the town zoning laws and other laws with regard to development. This issue has been before the Supreme Judicial Court, the state Supreme Judicial Court before, and it's going to be back before them again. The Attorney General, Martha Coakley, is who filed this suit this week on behalf of the state. And they want the court to unequivocally say that the Aquinnah tribe signed away their right to build a casino really anywhere, and signed away most of their sovereignty in this land settlement agreement, which was ratified by Congress in, I believe it was 1987. Yeah, 1987.
Right. It was approved by Congress in 1987.
That's now, of course, where there's a little bit of, I guess, wiggle room, if you will, on legal interpretation is a number of tribe members hold that, well, how could we have possibly ceded a right that didn't yet exist? The Indian Gaming Act, of course, wasn't established until 1988. Now, clearly, there were talks ahead of that federal legislation giving Indian tribes the right to operate casinos in states where they're legalized. But still, the tribe has maintained that, well, we didn't sign away all of our rights, and it's sort of embedded in law over the years that Indian tribes have the right to do this, and we're going to pursue that. Now, it was interesting that, you know, there was this a tribal election that took place in the midst of all of this. And so the former tribal, actually, she's still the tribal council chairwoman, at least until January, Cheryl Andrews Malatis. She actually lost resoundingly to Tobias Vanderhoop. And then, of course, after that election, Tobias is sort of, it sounds like he's sort of backing off of the, we're going to open a bingo hall casino, but they're still going to fight this because they still, I think, as a tribe, believe that they didn't actually sign away all of their rights. And so this particular case is going to go before the state Supreme Judicial Court, and it'll be interesting to see how they rule, because previously in land disputes, the state Supreme Judicial Court said, no, tribe, you do need to abide by that agreement. So even if they do rule that it'll be a big blow to the tribe. But then, of course, who knows? Maybe it'll actually find its way into the federal court system or the Supreme Court.
When you say a bingo parlor, you're not talking, you know, B27. It's a
high
slot
stakes,
type thing.
A slot right? type thing. Class two, and without getting into all the different classes of casinos, class three is really the thing that everybody wants. It's the big mega resort casino license that you get where you can operate table games and slot machines and such. But a class two is sort of a mick casino, if you will, a smaller version of a casino.
Okay. And meanwhile, in tandem, as this is going on with the island Wampanoag tribe, we have the Mashpees, who are farther along in their quest for a casino. They're actually looking to open a casino with three hotels, a water park, and there were some meetings this week, hearings this week. Got pretty impassioned about that.
Right. Well, as you might expect, well, there were two hearings, and this is part of the environmental impact report that all tribes that are trying to open casinos have to go through. There's this big federal process, and so part of this process is to hold these hearings. They had one in Mashpee, and then they had one in Taunton. Now, the one in Mashpee was, you know, sparsely attended, mostly tribe members showed up, but then again, there's no plan to build a casino here in Mashpee. In Taunton, you know, it was the opposite story. Things got really heated there quickly. And, you know, a lot of the casino opponents turned out for that meeting, you know, just to let the federal government know, even though this is supposed to, this just looks at, you know, impacts of traffic and you know, the ecological impacts of opening a casino in that area. So technically, the comments are supposed to be limited to that. But of course, you know, anytime there's a public venue for people to express their outrage or their opposition to casinos, then they'll take the time to do so. And that's what happened up in Taunton.
Jesse Little Doe Baird, who listeners know well, she's been on our station before. She's well known. She gave quite an impassioned speech. And if I could just read a little bit of that.
Right.
She says, "You will hear from xenophobes, the skinheads, the NIMBYs, the folks who are put off of reservation lands when their lease is ended, and probably every other hate group east of the Mississippi, with every specious argument known to every single tribe that has followed this process since its inception in 1934. And then she went on to say, "We are a people directly tied to both Mashpee and Taunton through our blood."
I mean, those are strong words, which of course some folks took particular exception to at the meeting itself. And
well, you wonder, is that really what is motivating the opponents, or is it just they are concerned about gambling?
Well, I think it's a mixture of both. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, there's a lot of folks who just, you know, on principle, don't like the idea of anybody opening a casino, whether it's an Indian tribe, whether it's, you know, Donald Trump. They just don't want casinos for all of the various, you know, social consequences that can come in the wake. But, you know, in my coverage of Indian tribes over the years, particularly in, you know, the Mashpee Indian tribe, there's certainly a strain of folks who feel like Indian tribes or tribes that are operated by Indian casinos is somehow some special advantage or some special right. And, you know, according to the law, just for a bit of historical context, Congress said in their legislation of the Indian Gaming Act that in order for Indian tribes to sort of, you know, to become economically self-sufficient, to not rely on the government for reparations, essentially, for the historic treatment of Indians and so forth, that this was going to be one of the main vehicles for Indian tribes to gain economic self-sufficiency. Now, you know, people can argue of whether or not that's a good engine or not, but in fact, it is encoded into law, and we're, you know, we're decades down the road on that question. So, you know, certainly there's folks who are opposed to casinos, but there are also folks who feel like they're also opposed to this very notion that Indian tribes should get some kind of special treatment.
And this, the Gaming Act, my understanding is it was designed to trump anything that any deals that had happened before it, because so many times these tribes were forced into deals and giving up rights.
Exactly. And that's precisely the question that the courts are going to have to take up. Is a tribe even allowed to basically sign away rights? I mean, you know, I suppose it's possible for the court to say, listen, you did kind of sign away your rights, but you really shouldn't have. It wasn't a good deal for you. So we'll see. As I mentioned before, in the past, the court has upheld what the state has been arguing.
Okay. Let's talk to Tim Wood. He's joining us on the phone. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Morning, Sean.
And Tim, you had a great story this week. We had reported about NOAA no longer publishing the nautical charts, and you did some digging about a gentleman back in the 1800s who was really involved in those charts.
Sure. You know, it's an interesting angle to this story. Back in the mid-1800s, a Chatham native named George Eldridge, who was a ship captain, got injured, couldn't go to sea anymore, and he started making navigation charts of local waters. And he eventually became known as Chart George because his reputation for accuracy and the quality of his charts was so high. He ended up doing charts for much of the New England and East Coast. And he pioneered some techniques, triangulation, that hadn't been used before for accuracy on the charts. He would note a lot of features that, you know, at the same time, the government was also putting out their own charts, and he worked for them for a while, but he ended up going into business for himself doing this, and his charts were a little more folksy. Even though they were accurate, you would find little notations on them about things to avoid that might not be on the government charts. He also put out a coastal pilot book and a tide guide that were extremely popular through the early 1900s. After his death, his son carried on the business. And Eldridge's charts today are still they're popular collector's items. They can sell for up to $5,000 a piece.
Are you hearing anything from contemporary sailors or mariners about this decision to no longer produce those charts?
Yeah, the decision was made because electronics today have not made charts redundant, but people rely less on them, so the government hasn't had the kind of demand that they used to have for charts. What I'm hearing is that most experienced mariners will always have a chart on board. The Coast Guard and the local harbor masters told us that they definitely recommend that boaters always have a paper chart on board, even if they have the latest in electronics, because, you know, you take a rogue wave or something happens and you could lose all your electronics. And, you know, if you don't have a chart and you're not familiar with the waters, you're kind of in trouble. So they say it's prudent to always have a paper chart on board, even if you aren't used to using it. You know, learn how to use it and don't rely solely on those electronics.
Tim, another story you have is about a fee. I guess the Board of Selectmen are looking to have a fee at Sacquatucket Harbor.
Yeah, in Harwich, the Harwich Selectmen have asked their staff to look into what it would look like to have a parking fee at the Sacquatucket Harbor parking lot. There's already a fee in place on the east side of the parking lot, which is used in conjunction with a launching ramp there. But the west side of the parking lot has always been open for free parking to the public, and it's used by slip holders, passengers on the Nantucket Ferry that operates out of the harbor, and charter boats and local businesses. And it's often crowded this summer. It was hard to find a parking space there during the day. The harbor master says people are complaining about it. And at this point, there's been no mention of how much of a fee would be charged. Harbor Master John Rendon is planning to canvass slip holders and charter boat owners, as well as local businesses, to find out how they feel about a fee. Selectmen were warned that any revenue from a fee really couldn't be used to just simply beef up the general fund. It would have to be applied to maintenance of the harbor and the parking lot. That's probably not a problem, since there's always something to do in a harbor. It won't be something that could, take care of the town's financial woes, but
right.
See it as a way to, make sure the parking lot is not used by people who are just leaving their car there for the day for no other reason. So
I see.
We'll see there. I think they'll have a report back within a couple weeks, and we'll see what happens.
Okay. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. He joins us on the news roundup each week. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Sean. Take care.
This is the News Roundup. When we discuss the top news stories of the week, I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Gonsalves, a news columnist at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Sean, I want to start with the nuclear power plant in Pilgrim. It was taken offline early Wednesday due to a leaking valve. It's been taken offline several times over the past year. Ironically, Entergy officials, the owners of the plant, were in town the night before talking about safety improvements to the plant.
Yeah, I mean, man, even when Entergy is trying to do something right or trying to get out ahead of, all of these stories about, the plant being shut down. And so here they are at Plymouth Town Hall, and they're trying to explain to folks that this plant is completely safe. We're on top of everything. And by the way, it's not exactly like the nuclear power plant over there in Fukushima that everyone's concerned about. And then just down the road, a few miles, there's this leak valve problem, which, of course, didn't get mentioned at all in the meeting. In fact, in the story that Christine Legere wrote, the Plymouth town manager said that she got a call after she walked out of the meeting. And she was quoted in our story as saying that the number of shutdowns and interruptions is concerning. It almost seems like every other week now we're seeing a story about you know, some kind of technical or mechanical problem at the plant that requires it to either power down it partially or shut down completely. And that's what they had to do this earlier this week. And it's just not very reassuring to a very skittish a public. And it's been the subject from the highest levels of state officials down to local activists clamoring, you know, first of all, not wanting the plant to be relicensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which did happen. Their plant was given an extension, I think, of 20 years.
Yep.
This is a 40-year-old plant. And it seems like the plant is starting to show, yep, I, you know, 40 years old, and now you're having these, you know, these various mechanical breakdowns.
And, of course, the nation's fleet of nuclear power plants are monitored by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And one of the criticisms that the commission gets is it's very incestuous with the private industry. And then we have another story today that kind of speaks to that.
Well, I mean, again, you know, they're not doing themselves any favors if they truly are concerned about this perception that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is sort of this rubber stamp agency, and ties to the nuclear industry is so close that it really isn't a watchdog in any real sense of the term. And then you've got this story today about a former Pilgrim plant worker. Entergy owns Pilgrim Nuclear. Former Entergy worker, Brian Scarabeck, or Scrabeck, I hope I'm sure I'm mangling his name. But he was hired to be the on-site overseer of the Pilgrim plant. And automatically you say to yourself, how is it that a guy that used to work for Entergy is now in charge of overseeing the safety on behalf of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission? Of course, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission answer is, well, there's only few people in the world that are qualified to do this type of job, and you know, it's people that used to have worked in the industry. And in fairness to him, you know, he does have, you know, a good resume. You know, he was a naval sub, a nuclear sub.
Right, you're right. I mean, they look to the industry, they look to the Navy, and they look to recent graduates from graduate programs. And that's, so they say, we have a small pool to choose from, and this man will be, there's oversight over him, and they don't expect any issues with that. Let's move on. Sally Rose is joining us on the phone. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Sean.
Let's talk about the police report. We didn't have you on last week, and that's when this release of a police report about you know, all the troubles that have been going on in Provincetown regarding its department there. Tell us about what the report said.
That's right. Well, it was released a week ago Monday evening during the selectmen's meeting, and this, just to remind people, this is a report by the independent investigator that the Board of Selectmen requisitioned. And he found in the report that Provincetown Police Chief Jeff Jaron violated state and town laws when he held at least two meetings during which he talked to on-duty police officers and other members of the department about whom they should support in the May 7th selectman election. And further, he asked a subordinate to pick up and distribute campaign signs for a particular candidate. In addition to the election violations, the report also said that the chief acted inappropriately on election night when the rap song that's critical of police started playing inadvertently in a restaurant bar. That was when he reportedly started yelling at the bartenders, believing that they were playing it deliberately. And he further then directed officers to ID everyone in the bar that night. After the investigator presented his findings to the selectmen, they decided to schedule a disciplinary hearing with the chief. That's scheduled to be held on this coming up, the December 11th.
And Sally, I'm not clear. So with the Squealing Pig incident, when the chief heard what he found to be an offensive song related to violence against police officers, and he had requested the bartender shut that off. So did they find fault in that, you're saying?
Well, they just described it as that he acted inappropriately, that it was very believable that he did, that his voice was raised or yelling or whatever, that from the interviews that the investigator conducted, that it was certainly believable that he did yell and acted inappropriately. They described it as inappropriate.
I see. And then, of course, asking police officers to go in and take patrons' names is right. part of that inappropriate.
Right. Now, action. I don't. It didn't actually happen because of kind of a series of events, so they didn't have to ID people, but they did it in sort of a different way because I think the officer that went in was uncomfortable about doing it.
I see. I interrupted you. So they're planning a disciplinary hearing?
Right. That's to be held on December 11th. That's scheduled for December 11th. And just as a reminder, the chief was suspended with pay on September 12th, and that had followed a vote of no confidence by the police unions.
Okay. We'll continue to follow that story, of course. Meanwhile, an aquaculture area, development area off of Provincetown and Truro, it's been delayed, but now they have an approval. What's happening there? Why was it delayed? What's the concern?
Well, this is interesting. This is a little background. The towns of Provincetown and Truro, they've been working together with the state and the feds over the last several years to set up a deep water aquaculture development area offshore of both of the towns. The ADA is a total of 50 acres, and that's 25 for each town. The progress was pretty steady over the first year or so with the initial permitting, but in the last year, as you said, they've run into a lot of delays, mostly because of concerns by the State Division of Marine Fisheries about floating cages that have been proposed to be used in the ADA. The state is worried about their potential for causing whale and sea turtle entanglements. So both the towns, because of that, both the towns and several shell fishermen who've already been awarded grants by the town, they've been in a bit of limbo. But as you said, this week the state gave the project a green light. It's a green light with limits, though. The head of DMF, Paul Diodati, he sent a letter to the towns giving an okay to what he described as controlled development for the use of those floating cages, so essentially a test program. And the towns have State Rep Sarah Peek to thank for helping to broker this deal. He also said, though, no new grants will be awarded until the results of this pilot program are known.
Very interesting. Aquaculture, of course, is a bright spot when it comes to fishing here in this area these days.
Right.
Sally Rose, the editor of the Provincetown Banner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay, bye, Sally. Sean Gonzalez here in the Woods Hole studio. Tell me about this. You know, Cape Cod has been dealing with this wave of addiction problems related to opiate abuse. It's been all over the papers, and now there's concern about a new opiate, this Zohydro ER. I guess ER stands for extended release, that's about to hit the market.
That's right. It's the latest opioid painkiller, and it's apparently it's very powerful, and a lot of folks think it is very addictive. In fact, not just any old folks, but the advisory committee of the FDA, who actually recommended 11-2 when they voted in December against approving the product. The FDA, though, went ahead earlier this week, I believe, and approved it anyway. And it's really raised quite a ruckus among the medical profession that deals with a lot of people who, you know, are having a lot of addiction problems, and particularly for, you know, families of people who are dealing with, you know, addicts in their families. I mean, we've in Pills That Kill series that we've run in our paper, we've had countless stories. Casey Myers covers this well, and it's a real scourge here on the Cape. You know, people who become addicted to these opiates by using painkillers. And so a lot of folks, including Joanne Peterson, who's the founder of Learn to Cope, which is this you know, statewide support group for family members of addicts, they're outraged. They are just outraged that the FDA could approve a drug that they feel that, you know, the risk of people falling into addiction far outweigh the benefits. Of course, the FDA says the exact opposite in their ruling.
Well, I'm interested in the FDA's perspective. But the story also points out an interesting irony that this is a company that has one of the leading drug treatment drugs out there that just came out.
That's right, Vivitrol. It's it's really a salvation for a lot of addicts. It's something that the local jail, the Barnstable County Sheriff uses to, you know, you get a lot of times addicts that come in through the jail. In fact, a lot of people in jail actually have addiction problems.
Of course.
And this Vivitrol is not addictive, and it's actually long been used to deter people from alcohol abuse, but it's given in these single injections, and apparently it prevents users from being able to even get high on any kind of opiates or alcohol for up to a month. And so it's been a real lifesaver for a lot of folks, and so that makes this all the more of a head scratcher for some people, which is not only how would the FDA approve this new drug, the Zohydro ER, but the company that has made this sort of salvific drug, Vivitrol, how is it that they're putting out this other drug that has the potential to really, wreck some lives, a lot of people feel?
And so what is the FDA's perspective? It seems like the difference between this Zohydro and a similarly based drug like Vicodin is this is an extended release drug.
Right.
So it presumably can provide some relief to people who suffer pain day in and day out and don't want a quick dose of opiates, but something that
As the FDA put it, they said that the available data support the idea that this Zohydro ER is safe and effective to treat pain that's severe pain we're talking about, and to be able to treat it around the clock. So they consider it a long-term treatment, and that really that the alternatives that currently exist are inadequate, they say.
I see. Let's talk about this new training program. There were some folks being trained here on the Cape to become instructors of what's called the ALICE Training Institute. I've read about this a bit. It's somewhat controversial because of what it tells teachers and children to do if there is an intruder.
That's
in
right.
School.
Yeah. I mean, basically, and another way of looking at it, I think, is that some folks would say, well, this is sort of commonsensical, but what it essentially trains people, and maybe we should say that ALICE stands for Alert, Lockdown, Inform, Counter, Evacuate. Those last two words are key because what they're training people, mostly staff, I think in some instances students, which they say they do sort of age appropriate, which is to train them to not just sit there, to do something, to either, get out of there, to do something to distract a shooter, throw books, these kind of things. And so what they did is George Brennan went, they had a drill in Chatham in which they had this masked gunman come in. It was a simulation. They had the masked gunman kick in the door. He had a gun in each hand and was able to kill 17 of the 25 people in that room in 43 seconds. And it was because they were all stationary. None of them were mobile. And for those that were there, it was a pretty sobering. I mean, I think, of course, in the back of a lot of people's minds are, these school shootings that we've hearing about, so often. And so the whole idea behind it is really, like I said, is sort of a commonsensical approach. But to say, listen, most shooters don't stop until they are taken out or taken down. And so don't just stand there and be a sitting duck. Get up and move. And unfortunately, the folks that run this program say that most of these lockdown drills and lockdown procedures that schools do require in many instances to kids to do just that, to sit in one
together.
Spot, to sit together. And
it's counterintuitive in a way, isn't it?
It really is. And so, but as you said, it is controversial. I mean, I think for some parents, I'm sure they're concerned about, wait a minute, you're going to have, folks come into the school and talk to my little Johnny about, how to avoid getting shot and how to possibly fight back. And so I think that just to even talk about that subject for a lot of people feels it's a heavy topic. It's scary. And I think that makes some folks feel uncomfortable.
Right.
One of the things I thought was interesting was there were a number of police officers who were at this particular training in Chatham. And at one point, the instructor said to the police officers, how many of you have children in schools? And all of them did. And then he said, now, how many of you instruct your children that if there were an active shooter in the school to just sit there? And he asked, he did this by asking them to first stand up if they had children and then asked them to sit back down again if they told their children to just essentially sit there and all of them remained standing, which, I think was sort of, implying that, on the side, they're telling their kids, listen, if there's ever an incident like this in school, I don't care what the teacher says, you look for a way to get out of there or you do something to avoid getting shot.
Well, I don't know if that's the right thing to be telling the kid either, but certainly we're trying to find our way as you say, encounter more of these shooting incidents. It's a terrible thing to have to even deal with. Let's talk about speed limits to protect whales, and those are under review. They've been in place for a few years now. They're up for renewal, but the industry, the shipping industry, is saying, hold on a bit. Don't make these rules permanent.
Right. So they're set to expire on December 9th. And, as you can imagine, a lot of people in the industry say, well, these slow down our ships and that costs us money and so forth. But on the other hand, we're talking about, an endangered species that apparently it seems that these speed limits have been working. I mean, the last analysis that that the Humane Society has looked at shows that from 2008 to 2012, that there wasn't a single right whale death because of a ship strike. And that's important, and we're starting to see some of the numbers of these endangered species. I think, you know, what was it, less than 10 years ago, there were maybe 300 or so in the world, and now I think there's a couple hundred more. It's almost, the population has almost doubled. And so
how fast can the ships go?
They're supposed to, the restrictions require that vessels that are 65 feet or longer are supposed to slow down to 10 knots or less. And that's during certain times of the year where in these known areas where whales calve and feed and migrate all along the East Coast. Those are called seasonal management areas. And so, and those limits apply from January 1st through May 15th. And then later on also in the year. And then there's also these things called dynamic management areas where mariners are sort of encouraged. They're not required, but they're, it's sort of the yellow caution light, and it's a way of saying, please slow down, although it's not actually required in those other areas.
And the shipping industry, they say this costs them money?
Yeah, I haven't seen any real figures. Wait a minute. $79 million actually. I'm just now looking at it here.
$79 million a year.
$79 million a year annually. And so, you know, that's not chump change. And so they're they're looking to see if I think they feel like they know how to navigate their way around the rails without hitting them. But the comment period, I think, is just about up, and so I think in the next week or so, they're going to make a decision as to whether or not they're going to extend these speed limits.
This is the News Roundup, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me here in Woods Hole is Sean Gonsalves, a news columnist at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. And joining us on the phone is Josh Balling, the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Let's talk about Stop and Shop. The island's been waiting to hear what Stop and Shop is going to do, and they're going to build, I guess.
They're going to build on the same site as the existing Mid-Island store between Sparks Avenue and Pleasant Street. You're absolutely right. The Islanders have been waiting for years to see what Stop and Shop was going to do in terms of a new facility. The existing building, about 30,000 square feet, not nearly big enough, especially in the summertime. Both customers and store officials say there's really no storage. The aisles are narrow. It's a pretty dingy store by all accounts, even among the store officials. And they're looking to build a 37,000 square foot store on the same property, on the side of the parking lot that's adjacent to the Nantucket Fire Department. Keep the old store open while they're doing it, because there really aren't too many other supermarket options on the island. Stop and Shop also runs the downtown supermarket right on Nantucket Harbor, but it's a much smaller store, and store officials felt that just keeping that one open wouldn't be a good option, so they're going to keep the smaller store open while they build the new one. They hope to begin construction next fall, providing all the regulatory approvals are in hand, and it should take about 8 to 9 months, they say, basically right over the off season, and they hope to be open by early May of the following year in 2015, again, if everything goes according to plan. Parking, they say, will be increased. They will put a bakery in the new store. Plans a little bit up in the air for now based on how their regulatory hurdles are overcome, but it looks like there's going to be a newer, larger Stop and Shop for island customers and summer visitors, hopefully within the next couple of years.
And they already own the parcel of land? I mean, it's on the same property.
It's on the same parcel of land that the existing store is on. They're going to reconfigure the parking. Basically, for anybody who's familiar with the store, they're going to flip it on the site. The new store will be on the opposite side of the property from the existing store, and they'll move the parking to that side of the lot. Stop and Shop also owns another parcel up the street next to the Boys and Girls Club, but they determined after talking to the community and doing some studies that that really wouldn't be an optimum site for a new store. They don't know exactly what they're going to do with that property yet. They own a portion of it and lease the rest of it from Atlantic Development of Hingham. Some kind of development obviously is going to happen there. It's a little unclear now what that might be, whether it's mixed-use commercial with some residential built in or strictly commercial. But in the Mid-Island area, there's been quite a bit of development of mixed-use variety in recent years. It's really become the hub of island commerce, especially in the off-season.
And the people just keep coming to Nantucket. You have a big weekend this weekend, one of the biggest holiday weekends, right?
One of the biggest holiday weekends of the year. It's our annual Christmas stroll weekend, the 40th anniversary Christmas stroll, as a matter of fact. And even though the weather doesn't look like it's going to be optimum for a Christmas stroll weekend, a little bit of rain in the forecast, some winds and some dampness, certainly no snow, but no nice weather either. That's not stopping anybody from getting here. Usually about 10,000 people come for the stroll. By all accounts, so far, people started trickling in on Wednesday. A lot more came in yesterday, and the boats and planes are full today. A lot going on, full slate of activities starting tonight, going all the way through Sunday. most of it downtown, some of it around the outside, the Mid-Island and elsewhere. Lots of entertainment, strolling carolers, music downtown on Main Street and around a number of the venues down there, theatrical performances, and lots of Christmas shopping. Most of the stores, it's sort of their last hurrah before closing down, and or at least sort of hunkering down for the winter. Lots of sales, lots of promotions, lots of people come over and shop here, and lots of Islanders get out too and enjoy one last festive atmosphere before we start to quiet down for the season.
Okay. Thanks, Josh. Josh Balling is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon. Sean Gonsalves here in our Woods Hole studio. Tell me about this bill. The state is looking to make it easier to permit land-based wind turbines, and so they had some hearings related to that, and they heard from folks from Falmouth.
Right. I think this is really a way to get this Wind Energy Siting Reform Act moving again. A few years ago, there was this, Wind Energy Siting Reform Act, which, of course, the governor supported to create this process by which, we could get more land-based wind turbines. Now, since that time, since it was first introduced, of course, there's been, story after story and problem after problem from residents who live in and around land-based wind turbines, who say it causes them, a number of problems, from sleep disturbance to headaches to, all kinds of physical.
Some residents, not everyone who lives.
Not everyone, but some residents. And one of those particular residents, Neil Anderson, was at the State House earlier this week. Tuesday, there was a hearing before the Joint Committee on Telecommunications, Utilities, and Energy, trying to take up this matter again. And he was really, testifying in behalf, of course, emphasizing that there needs to be real strong rules in place in terms of where these things are located in relative to, homes. And there were other, there was other testimony there. The president of the Environmental League of Massachusetts agreed that the state does need to set some standards in terms of, that both protects residents but also allows wind energy, to move forward. And so the idea is, and you hear a lot about this, outside of wind energy, but with regards to business in general in the state, that sometimes the regulatory process or the permitting process is a little too cumbersome. You have to go to all of these different agencies. And so you hear about this one-stop permitting. And that's what essentially this is about, is to try to bring together local boards into this single panel that would, have like a representative from the town's conservation commission, one from the planning board, one from the zoning board of appeals. Mm-hmm. And essentially you go before them all at once. And if you get a permit, you're out of there and you're able to move forward with the project.
And of course, Neil Anderson has become something of the poster child for folks opposed to these wind turbines. And he was very forthright in inviting legislators and environmentalists and whomever else to come and sit on his porch and see what happens.
That's right. And in fact, I've written columns about, raising questions about, the veracity of some of the complaints.
Have you sat on Neil Anderson's porch?
But I haven't sat on Neil Anderson's porch, so maybe I should take him up on that offer. Although, as I understand it, sometimes you have to spend, a good deal of time there to sort of get the gist. But no, I, in fairness, I haven't sat on Neil Anderson's porch, but it'd be interesting to see if some legislators take him up on the offer. I would imagine State Representative Dave Vieira from Falmouth would. Mm. He also testified Tuesday in support of the this proposal to create this wind energy relief fund that would take, get $15 million a year, actually, from the Massachusetts Renewable Energy Trust Fund. And that money would be used to compensate the Neil Andersons of the world, but also businesses and municipalities harmed by wind turbines, which I thought was a little interesting, because most of the concern that you hear about land-based wind turbines come from residents. And yet, he's sort of talking about expanding this to compensate also businesses and municipalities. But, it seems like in our experience, there's whenever businesses or municipalities erect them, it's not a problem for them. It's actually seen as a way to reduce utility costs for them. So, yeah, I'm not quite sure about the business and municipalities aspect of it, but essentially he wants to create this fund that could be used to, compensate the Neil Andersons of the world and maybe even, buy homes in certain cases. I don't know.
Let's talk about renewable energy, but let's talk about solar. There are a couple energy agencies here on the Cape and the islands that are working towards installing solar, and they've come under some significant scrutiny, and now the board, the Barnstable County of Assemblies is saying, look, we need some help sorting this out.
And they're asking for it from the Attorney General. And, you know, this story, I think part of the reason why this story is a bit convoluted for people that don't follow this carefully, but essentially there's the Cape Light Compact and the Cape and Vineyard Electric Cooperative. Now, the compact was set up in 1987 to basically buy electricity in bulk to set up energy efficiency programs, you know, to advocate for electric customers or electric ratepayers both on the Cape and Martha's Vineyard. Now, the cooperative was set up in 2007 to pursue renewable energy projects, but a lot of the money that that cooperative gets comes from the compact. Now, the reason why that's a problem for some folks is that the compact, when it was originally formed and established back in 97, it was sold as this is a way for us to buy electricity in bulk for people in this region and save people money. But as it turns out, folks who actually get their power supply directly from NSTAR, or actually now it's, I forget the latest iteration of what NSTAR is, or maybe it is still NSTAR.
They were bought still recently. Is.
Okay. Northeast Utilities.
Yeah,
Right, right, right. so if you stuck with them, you'd actually be paying a little bit less on your electric bill. And so some people feel like, well, number one, you guys are misrepresenting yourself and saying that you're going to save people money. And then I think some people are thinking that some of that extra money that they're getting is now supporting these various renewable energy projects. And we should also mention, not everyone, part of this, for some people who are asking for the state attorney general to look into this, and which is what the Barnstable County Assembly of Delegates voted to do.
Right.
It's an issue of transparency. It's an issue of what's the exact relationship between these two entities. For some people, it's really they're opposed to a lot of these renewable energy projects pursued by these entities and are really trying to figure out what is the funding source.
I think you're right. I think you hit the nail on the head at the very beginning when you said how convoluted this is. I think from my reading, some assembly people are confused by this and are looking to the state not so much because they think there is some criminal or you know, nefarious thing going on here. It's more, we don't understand this. Can you sort this out as dollars move back and forth from these two entities? And meanwhile, as you said, there's been one particular gentleman, this Mr. Eric Bibler, mm-hmm. who's been driving this train.
Right.
And what has concerned me as I've read his emails and is this lack of providing basic documents to the public about how these things are set up.
Exactly. And so, you know, not everybody will necessarily agree with the aims of Mr. Bibler.
Right.
But certainly
you should have the financial documents.
But you should have the financial documents. And so, and there's even been instances where people within the assembly have requested information and haven't gotten it from
the assembly members.
From these county agencies or from these regional agencies. And so that in and of itself doesn't sit well with
you
people.
You can't get the big picture if you can't see the documents. It doesn't make sense to me. All right, let's move on. I was very interested in this story about Lyme sufferers getting a place of their own. There's a gentleman here on the Cape in mm-hmm. Mashpee mm-hmm. whose wife has suffered. I've interviewed her a few times, and it's a terrible thing. Suffers from Lyme, and so he's looking to help all people with Lyme here on the Cape.
That's right. He's one. Ron, you're going to have to help
me. Is it Giamani?
Jajami, Ron Jajami.
He's Jajami, yep.
He's one of the founders of the Lyme Awareness of Cape Cod. Anyhow, he's published this 1,800 square foot office condo that used to be a tanning salon, and he's going to turn this into the Lyme Disease Health and Wellness Center. And it's pretty, I think, really a one of a kind thing here in this region, which has really been struck by Lyme disease. There's a lot of folks who suffer with it, and Lyme disease is something that you don't want to live with. You know, it's something that won't kill you immediately, or it won't kill you if you don't, you know, if you get it treated, but it's not pleasant to have. And so his plan is to bring on board this, what he calls a Lyme literate healthcare professional that can write prescriptions. A nutritionist, an acupuncturist, a counselor, even to have these infrared saunas, which I guess some Lyme patients say helps alleviate their symptoms. And he's hoping to open the center by the springtime. So for the 400 or so confirmed cases just on the Cape and Islands of this past year, on top of all the other folks, I mean, this is real good news for folks that are suffering with Lyme.
Very difficult Lyme disease to diagnose. And, of course, people who suffer say one of their main problems is finding healthcare professionals who believe that they are suffering from Lyme disease and who will prescribe drugs.
Right.
So it looks like he's trying to get one of those Lyme-literate doctors.
Absolutely. And in fact, he's so serious about it that he even wants to set aside $50,000 to help people that don't, you know, that don't have the resources to get treatment.
Representative Cleon Turner is retiring, and folks here on the Cape certainly know him. Five terms,
that's right. So he says, look, I'm 69 years old, or at least I will be at the end of my term, and for him it sounds like a pretty good time to retire. And so that's what he's going to do after five terms. And, you know, I think, you know, he's a Democrat, of course, out of Dennis, but he's somebody that has a lot of respect among the entire Cape delegation. You know,
I think it even goes beyond the Cape delegation.
Absolutely.
Right?
I mean, well, first of all, when he first came into the State House, he sort of carved out a reputation as being willing to sort of not go along with just the leadership on everything. And so he formed the regional school caucus that recruited lawmakers sort of outside of the 495 Beltway to raise awareness about regional schools. And so a lot of folks credit that particular body with getting some of the regional schools some additional transportation monies, which is why in 2006 the Massachusetts Association of School Committees had named him Legislator of the Year. But I think one of the reasons why he has so much respect among his legislative colleagues is because of what are known as these calendar sessions. He apparently has encyclopedic knowledge of every bill.
Well, boil it down. He reads the bills. They go to him
even on the floor and say, hey, Cleon, what exactly is in that bill? And he has this uncanny ability really to remember and tell you specifics. And, you know, reading bills is something that we would think that all of our legislators would do. But aside from that, though, there is a little bit of a knack for reading bills and understanding what they actually say, because so much of it is written in sort of legal speak.
Sure it is. It's written by lawyers. Right. Okay, let's talk about this memorial service for actress Julie Harris, and you know, she was a Cape-based woman.
She
did
a lot for the arts. She lived in West Chatham, and you know, she was considered to be a legend of the theater. And I've got to be honest with our listeners, I'm not a theater goer myself. I know who Julie Harris is, but mostly because as a kid, my grandmother was a big fan of Knott's Landing, and so back in those days, with one TV in the house, I watched Knott's Landing too, and that's how I know who Julie Harris is. But she had this memorial service that, you know, actors from all over, Christopher Plummer, Hal Holbrook, Joan Van Ark, Rosemary Harris, they all showed up. A lot of people from the Cape that knew her in local theater showed up, and it was just a moving tribute. Of course, she died in August, but they wanted to have this memorial service for her, and it was a moving tribute just for, you know, just to recognize, you know, what an iconic, legendary figure she is in theater. And also, I just thought it was interesting that, you know, she had real deep ties. She didn't just have a house on the Cape and stayed in her house or just was here for a few weeks. I mean, she was really involved in local theater, and she, you know, she's...
Well, what a thing to have a five-time Tony, a winner, you know, doing local theater.
Three Emmys, too.
Oh, and three. I mean, of course, I'm sure we could go on and on. I mean, highly respected, and of course, a real patron for the arts here on the Cape.
One of the things that I liked in the story was it talked about how, you know, at the Wellfleet Harbor Actors Theater, how sometimes after shows she would go backstage and talk to the local actors and tell them, and that meant a lot to people. And I, you know, I like that anecdote because it kind of lets you know that she wasn't just somebody who stayed off in the distance; that she really loved theater, including local theater.
Well, that's what's happening. Big thanks to Sean Gonsalves, a news columnist at the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com, for coming into the studio today. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
Great thanks to Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer Mirror, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, and Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner. And I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.